From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed.
I would like to think that we encourage people to learn, and we invite people to do so in a way that is non-judgmental. So you don't need to be a musicologist or ethnomusicologist to come to our concerts and appreciate. You don't have to have prior knowledge or experience. You don't need to come with any kind of guilt, you know, post-2020 guilt around, I don't know, I've never heard this music, and it never bothered or crossed my mind to even question who I hear and who I see on stage, and sort of approach this with any kind of sense of guilt. But you can come into a space and know that there will be something for you to learn and something for you to also contribute towards. So I would hope that the space we create is something that we do with great care and translates as being done with great care and is able to provide an opportunity to really be curious, to learn and be curious.
That's Ashley Gordon. She's a violist and co-founder and artistic and executive director of Castle of Our Skins. Castle of Our Skins is a concert and educational series dedicated to celebrating Black artistry through music. Ashley Gordon and Anthony R. Green, classmates from the New England Conservatory of Music, founded the Boston-based organization in 2013. It was born out of their desire to foster cultural curiosity and to address the lack of Black voices in Western classical music. A recent grantee of the Arts Endowment, Castle of Our Skins aims to highlight the achievements of Black artists through creative concert programs which weaves music with visual art, dance, history, and storytelling, as well as educational workshops designed for both in and out of the classroom. By collaborating with arts organizations across Boston and operating as a collective of musicians, artists, dancers, historians, and storytellers, Ashley Gordon has amplified the reach of Castle of Our Skins and has brought many more Black voices into the spotlight. I know how difficult it is to start a successful arts organization, and it's typically not the career path a musician takes upon completing her MFA. And that's the first question I put to Ashley Gordon. Ashley, when most classical musicians graduate from the conservatory, they hope for a solo career, they hope to join an orchestra. But when you graduated from the New England Conservatory of Music, you made a very different decision.
Yes, I did. And that decision took about maybe 10 years or so to really live into and fully appreciate. So as you had mentioned, being an orchestral musician, having that as a career goal was definitely front of mind. That's really one of the reasons why I even wanted to become a professional musician was seeing a live orchestra. I remember second row sitting in front of the violins and being really enamored with the experience of live energy and live music making. But I did not feel comfortable in that setting. I have a lot of ideas and I wanted to be able to express those ideas. I am appreciative of having the space to be able to think and create and build out a series, a concert series, having social and political ideas that I can work with in addition to music making, and having that freedom to be able to have the sort of self-agency is something that I really appreciate and didn't necessarily find a home in the orchestral sphere. So I very much, again, appreciate chamber music. Solo playing is something that I also recognized is maybe not necessarily my strong suit, but definitely a collaborative space working with others. So wanted to find a way to have a chamber music outlet that I could do professionally and that could support me professionally. In addition to also having a space where I could educate. I really do appreciate one-on-one intimate opportunities, and being able to do that professionally in my work is something that I've really tried to build out as an entrepreneur.
You and your fellow classmate at the New England Conservatory of Music, Anthony Green, founded Castle of Our Skins in 2013. First, what is the significance of the name Castle of Our Skins?
Yes, Castle of Our Skins comes from a poem by Nikki Giovanni, and that poem is called Poem for Nina, as in Nina Simone. And to paraphrase, it says, we are all imprisoned in the castle of our skins, and if that's the case, treat our skin this castle as being a warm, welcoming, invitational place to live, adorn it with beautiful things, really celebrate and honor it. So celebration, beauty, excellence, blackness are really wrapped up in that poem and are really wrapped up in this organization as being foundational to our mission. And Anthony Green, pianist, composer, social justice activist, definitely a classmate of mine. Graduation, Ashley Gordon, Anthony Green, we were literally next to one another. And I think the universe had positioned us to be classmates at New England Conservatory to really found this organization, but very much wanted to have a space where we could support one another artistically as fellow Black musicians, predating Black student unions, which I know exist now in a lot of colleges and conservatories, but definitely didn't exist when we were students. And wanted to have an opportunity to learn more about ourselves and about our ancestry in our lineage as it extends certainly to New England Conservatory and the many graduates, Florence Price, one of them, Coretta Scott King, many, many Black graduates who attended the same hallways and walked the same paths we did, having a space to honor all of that. So very much a exploration. And now this platform that is one for collaboration is really wrapped into the journey of Castle of Our Skins.
Well, that's exactly where I was going. I wanted to ask you about that journey. I wanted to know what the goal was when you began in 2013 and how it's shifted and or expanded over the years.
Yes. Our original mission was to celebrate African-American composers and perform the music of African-American composers. And we have very much broadened that to celebrate Black artistry. And I think the impetus behind that shift was recognizing that African diasporic contributions extended 500 years, right, in the making for classical music, what we consider Western classical music, and certainly beyond this country, beyond this continent. So African-American composers, yes, certainly we program, but there's Afro-European and certainly African and Afro-Caribbean and Afro-Latino, again, 500 years worth, and wanted to be able to holistically express Blackness as it's holistically expressed, which is music and. So thinking of griots, thinking of storytellers, which use spoken word, which use movement, which use music, which use collective participation, communal participation, I am because we are sort of attitudes that are really integral to music making in African diasporic culture. So the idea of expanding to really celebrate Black artistry in its wholeness, music and music plus, is something that I think became very, very apparent early on. So we made that shift pretty early on.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I mean, you collaborate across disciplines and you collaborate with a lot of other organizations. Partnership, it could be your middle name. And I think one example is the incredibly rich and diverse show you put on a few years ago in 2018, Ain't I a Woman?
Yes, that one I'm very proud of. That had a brother presentation, I Am a Man, based off the sanitation strike in 1963, if I believe, or 68?
68.
Yeah, 68 sanitation strike. Slogan, I Am a Man. But Ain't I a Woman was a multifaceted project, music, obviously, as we are a music organization, but also included poetry by African diasporic women, a world premiere commission by New York-based composer Jessica Mays with original poetry that she also wrote. Since this was pre-pandemic, when we could be on-site in spaces, we had a on-site Black market to support local Black female entrepreneurs, so selling jewelry, selling handmade fashion design, selling handmade art pieces and things like this. And then as the whole entire evening was really in celebration of Black femininity, we had a pre-concert lecture to contextualize Black feminism and a post-concert dessert reception of just pure celebration, pure indulgence to celebrate really Black womanhood. The music was very expansive vocal traditions that extended from Elvayon Lakini in the early 1900s through, again, world premiere composition. So everything really rooted around Black feminism.
as artistic director, you're the person who really thinks about putting the season together. What goes into that thinking and planning?
I think with everything that we have done, as already been referenced, is done out of collaboration. So if there is an artist, visual artist, a dancer, a spoken word artist, another music organization that is mission aligned, I like to say, having a conversation and really just ideating together is how most things ultimately start. Same with venues, same with spaces, what kind of residency opportunities can be built out, and residencies being more than just a performance space, but what kind of educational opportunities, community engagement, workshops, sessions can happen to help build context around what it is we're trying to explore. And through that iterative process, the tip of the iceberg is the season, what we're able to share and build out. So next season, for instance, is our 10th anniversary, and we are literally starting with a ball. We're having a huge collaboration, celebration with a visual artist here in Boston, where I am based. Daniel Callahan is his name. Daniel Callahan uses a unique practice he calls masking, which is based on indigenous practices of body decoration, using the face literally as a canvas to create these beautiful works of art, transforming our person into a work of art, really a walking work of art. And having a huge celebration of communities of color that will happen in July at the Arnold Arboretum, which is also having many anniversaries, many celebrations, as it's really important and one of the first arboretums, public spaces in the country. That was a collaboration that has roots in a 2017 event that we also did. So many, many years project in the making, and being one that is something that starts from a simple conversation. And, you know, I enjoy what you do. How could we connect? Where are the overlaps?
Well, another collaboration was with the Stuart Gardner Museum, which was Witness Spirituals in the Classical mm-hmm. Musical Tradition, which is online for people who would like to see it. It's really wonderful. And I'd love to have you describe that show and how it came about.
Sure. Well, definitely the wonders of pandemic pivoting. Is
a word I never want to hear again.
Yes. So we were fortunate to have a great collaborative thought partner with the Gardner, specifically George Steele, who is the curator there. And we did a program pre-pandemic with invited guest cellist Seth Parker Woods, central piece Julius Eastman, Holy Presence of Joan of Arc for 10 cellos, and a Boston premiere Florence Price string quartet, and had a really great turnout and a really great energy around that collaboration, and wanted to do something the following year being pandemic year. So we couldn't do something in person, but George wanted to explore the archives of the Gardner. There was lots of history around the usage of that space, one of which included having performances of H.T. Burley and documents around African-American spirituals. So he wanted to take that and extrapolate and create, again, during the pandemic, a video docu-series around the Gardner, around spirituals, obviously having music, and wanted to illuminate its history and connection with the Gardner. So we were brought on board to perform works by Adolphus Hale Stork, William Dawson, for instance, and perform in different parts of the Gardner and help provide context around its historical significance.
And I have to add Frederick Tillis.
Yes, and Frederick Tillis.
That recording of Wade in the Water from Spiritual Fantasy number 12 was amazing. Performance, it was wonderful, but it's a string quartet. You're all masked. How is mm-hmm. playing with other people when you're masked?
Now it's so commonplace. It's almost like when I'm in a grocery store and I have my viola on my back. I don't know I have my viola until someone says, what's on your back. At this point, I don't recognize that I'm masked when I'm playing because I'm so used to it. But definitely early on, it was an extra barrier where so much about someone's physical body expressions is how we engage as chamber musicians. So a upturn of someone's eyebrow can help foreshadow a ritardando, for instance, and being able to see their mouth and see their full face as being part of how we communicate. That was definitely something that we had to get used to. I think really at this point, it's again commonplace and something we are comfortable with, but certainly early on was definitely something communicative that we needed to adjust to, and also acoustically, as sometimes playing with a mask can muffle the sound, ironically enough, under our ears.
We mentioned your educational programming. It's very robust. And I really, if you don't mind, would love to have you talk about some of it. You created something called Edutainment Recitals. So who are these for, and what is it that you do there?
Yes, I really enjoy Edutainment Recitals and our education, I guess what would be sort of traditional education or workshops and things like that for youth. Everything that we do, I consider educational. So whether that's a sold out concert or in a classroom, everything is foundationally related to education and fostering cultural curiosity. But the Edutainment Recitals are something that we developed as being more like tapas style, where it's a movement of this and a movement of that. And in the course of an hour, generally geared towards intergenerational, primarily youth, and then obviously youth and families, being able to experience a breadth of music making. So I had referenced 500 plus years of African diaspora contribution as composers, as creators in what we consider Western classical music. So being able to showcase that breadth in an hour with a movement of this and a movement of that, and providing historical contextualization around why this particular piece, why this particular composer, and how this composer who may have lived, I'm thinking Chevalier de Saint-Georges, for instance, Afro-French, who may have lived in the late 18th century, how that person connects to you today and how their story and history and legacy connect with you today. So sharing music and sharing educational information that is hopefully planting of a seed to encourage, again, intergenerational audiences to want to continue to learn more.
It's certainly first cousin to your deep dive series.
Yes, those are allowing me to sort of nerd out. I also teach at the Longy School of Music of Bard College, and I teach a course on composers of the African diaspora. So sort of repurposing some of my lectures around certain either composers, certain styles or groups of composers, the AACM, for instance, genres or styles of music. So an entire lecture around African-American spirituals, an entire lecture around Black female composers, entire lectures around orchestral music versus chamber music, that type of thing. And being able to take, as the name suggests, a deeper dive look into certain thematic areas of African diasporic music making.
What do you think Castle of Our Skins does best?
That's a great question. I would like to think that we encourage people to learn, and we invite people to do so in a way that is non-judgmental. So you don't need to be a musicologist or ethnomusicologist to come to our concerts and appreciate. You don't have to have prior knowledge or experience. You don't need to come with any kind of guilt, you know, post-2020 guilt around, I don't know, I've never heard this music, and it never bothered or crossed my mind to even question who I hear and who I see on stage, and sort of approach this with any kind of sense of guilt. But you can come into a space and know that there will be something for you to learn and something for you to also contribute towards. So I would hope that the space we create is something that we do with great care and translates as being done with great care and is able to provide an opportunity to really be curious, to learn and be curious.
I'm really curious about this, Ashley. What prepared you for running an organization, for writing the necessary grants, for being able to get permissions for music, for dealing with contracts?
A lot of that was learned on the job, on the fly, I have to say. But I think to expand a little bit about that, I have always been someone who is interested in bringing things to life. Had I not done music, I would have done graphic design. I was quite serious in high school, you know, divergent paths of either visual creation or musical creation, and ended up choosing music, but have always really been a person who liked to imagine So I have children's books, for instance, that I wrote and illustrated as a kid. And again, visual art, graphic design, seeing things and creating it on paper. So the idea of creating a concert series or facilitating a connection and bringing that to life also for me translates in that way of ideation to realization. And that had sort of traveled along with me in various spaces. So in college and in my master's programs, I was president of the American Viola Society chapter at my college and had leadership in other organizations as well too throughout my studies that would allow me to gain necessary skills of production, of coordinating, facilitating, reaching out, sort of cold calling, various at NEC, New England Conservatory, entrepreneurial type of opportunities in their career center. I was a work study student in their career center when Angela Miles Beeching was part of the career service center then. And remember, there was a wall of over 100 very, very colorful worksheets. So if you want to start a teaching studio, here's a worksheet on that. If you want to write a grant, here's a worksheet on that. If you want to build a resume, build a website, here's a worksheet on that. So there was a sort of a wealth of information that I was surrounded by, as well as my own practical skills that I had sort of amassed in other leadership roles. And really being able to connect with resources, ask questions and connect with resources. So in Boston, there's the Arts and Business Council. There's no shortage of newsletters and workshops for entrepreneurial artists and entrepreneurs across various disciplines, for profit and nonprofit, to learn technology skills, to learn grant writing skills, to learn sort of the non-musical skills. So literally the non-musical things that you need in order to bring your ideas to life are things that I had always sort of picked up and tried to find for many, many years, predating my time with Castle Bar Skins.
The pandemic certainly hit the performing arts very hard, as we know. And I want to know, how did you cope in terms of keeping the lights on, both literally and creatively?
Sure. Multiple pandemics, so certainly a health pandemic and obviously a racial pandemic. And as a Black arts institution, I do not speak solely for Castle of Our Skins when I say it was extremely stressful. And all of a sudden, in terms of the lights, I mean, they were hot spotlights. 2020 just blaring down on Castle of Our Skins and other Black arts institutions. So the external factors beyond our control just caused so much more attention to be brought to us. So that attention translated into financial attention and just people doing bake sales and selling CDs and all sorts of grants and organizations and individuals reaching out with financial support, with opportunities, et cetera. So there was definitely an overwhelming onslaught of that given the racial pandemics, which added a lot of stress, to be perfectly honest, for a very small organization such as Castle of Our Skins. So we didn't have, like other, I guess, non-Black arts organizations, a difficulty with keeping lights on for financial reasons and also keeping programming alive. It very much as a, again, community-minded, collaboratively-minded organization was never a question for me of stopping the work that we do. So finding opportunities to continue to make music, and if not make music, being able to support our spoken word artists with a sort of nightcap series where on social media for half an hour, they can present a series of poems. Our composers, we started during the pandemic, a Black Composer Miniature Challenge project for African diaspora composers to write 30-second miniatures, originally for viola and piano, myself, the violist, Anthony R. Green being the pianist, and we would record them virtually, Anthony living in the Netherlands at the time and myself being in Boston. We had about 19, I think, composers from North America, Africa, Europe, and I want to say Canada. Yeah, Canada in the United States. So that was a great project, which we have certainly continued, and like other organizations, really pivoting and seeing how we can leverage this digital space that we're in and also leverage the, again, really hot, intense lights that were being shown on us to make sure that our platform was one that was even more expansive geographically in terms of the voices that were being represented and as well as the disciplines that were being represented.
I listened to quite a few of the pieces in the Miniature Challenge, and I was struck by the range of them. Thank you. It was clear you and Anthony were not in the same place. And you managed to make music together on Zoom. And my hat is off to you. That is hard.
Yes, that is very difficult. Fortunately, we've known each other for many, many years. So we, despite being in different time zones, we could still connect and make music with one another. Yeah, it was a great project to early on in the pandemic, I should say, still have reason to practice, if for nothing more than 30 seconds a week, but to still have reason to practice when literally everything else had dried up, and obviously be able to provide so much room. We had an 11-year-old submit who didn't know how to notate his music on traditional five lines for spaces. So submitted just a recording of himself performing on piano. And I remember that and thinking that there would have been no other opportunity or way to have even connected with him had this challenge not been presented to him. And through the powers of the internet and connectivity that we have, I think, found during this time when we are socially isolated, being able to connect with someone so young and being able to provide an opportunity for him and the other composers as well has been really meaningful, to say the least.
You also received a grant from the Arts Endowment, ARP money, and I'm curious what that has allowed you to do or will allow you to do.
Yes. Again, so many blessings out of this very strange racial and health crisis that we're dealing with. But fortunately, we have been able to use those funds to expand our team. So what has largely been, for myself, artistic and executive director, a huge amount of work, really doing the work of many. Anthony, again, having been remote really since the founding and still being really actively involved with the organization, allowed for us to, again, expand our team. So we now fortunately have a director of education. We have a social media manager, a director of operations and community engagement. We now have a publicist. We have a bookkeeper. We are working towards having a development consultant. And ultimately, for me, I would love to really bring on a general manager and executive director to offload some of the responsibilities as you would find in an ED, so I can be more solely focused on artistic direction of the organization. So those funds have really allowed for us to expand our human resources, being able to also support more digital resources that's this, again, time of social distancing has really required of us. So the videography live streaming services, you had referenced, you know, licensing and sync licensing, which is certainly no small fee to have to account for. So to function during this time, certainly for one, and then also to lay real roots that will help us expand and operate, maintain some of this energy that we have had to just sort of rise to with the necessary humans on board to make it all happen.
I wonder, when you're looking at the landscape of arts institutions and during the crisis of the pandemic, during this racial reckoning that happens simultaneously, what could be learned or needs to be relearned that can be applied moving forward so arts institutions aren't stuck doing the same old, but as you say, there really are opportunities here.
Yeah, I think if anything, being able to listen, there have certainly been no shortage of conversations, no shortage of DEIA consultants who have been brought on board, no shortage of lectures, workshops, talks, et cetera, around racial equity, around especially in our field of music, specifically classical music, no shortage of these conferences and workshops and talks and lectures. So listening, I think, very much so. And then I think also making sure that what we are hearing, the various suggestions that, again, have been echoed and referenced and in many situations, I won't go into them now because, again, there's just a wealth of information and conversations that have already happened. But making sure that those efforts are built into long-term plans. So any sort of predecessor, especially in senior leadership, won't affect the institutional missions and visions and DEIA work that needs to happen. So whether that's 10-year, 15, 20-year plans that are built out into strategic plans, that are referenced at weekly meetings, that are referenced at retreats, that are kept alive as a living document and kept alive as living action, those shouldn't be attached, in my opinion, to your ED, to your board, to any physical person, but really through the life of the organization to really make sure that this is a sustained effort. So many colleagues that I have had pleasure of being on panels with and have listened to on various panels and workshops and things reference the cyclical nature of these sort of geyser moments where there is heightened awareness around racial equity and diversity and access and intersectional racial justice, these geyser moments, and then pretty sharply followed by collective amnesia. And then we have these, again, decades later, these geyser moments. So we are in, some may argue, on that decline to that collective amnesia, which historically and cyclically has happened. But I think if we really do build out these efforts to be long-term sustainable, just say for the next 50 years, or thinking about seventh generation mindset, what are you building now for seven generations in the future to make sure that we are really stabilizing our field and being consciously mindful now to prevent that steep decline or make it a little less jarring for future generations.
And I think that is a good place to leave it. Ashley, thank you. Thank you for the work you do.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Thank you for reaching out. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk and such thoughtful questions as well, too. So thank you for your time.
No, not at all. It's a pleasure. Thank you. That was violist and co-founder and artistic director of Castle of Our Skins, Ashley Gordon. You can keep up with concerts and programs of Castle of Our Skins at castleskins.org. And you can listen to their miniature concert series on YouTube. We'll have a link to both in the show notes, where you'll also find the music credits. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow Artworks on Apple Podcasts or Google Play and leave us a rating. It does help people to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe and thanks for listening.